attention. I can't get no call to action, but I try and I try and I try.
Hello and welcome to Call to Action, the go-to podcast for anyone trying to make sense of the world of marketing, business, and beyond. In an industry that is a minefield of utter bollocks, we aim to capture our heroes and allies from the front line to have a chinwag with. It's like Pokemon Go, with the single but vital exception that it's not a short-term bandwagon of shite. It's brought to you by Gasp, and I'm Giles Edwards. Today, I've caught Paul McVeigh. Even during his days as a top flight and international footballer, Paul developed a keen interest in the workings of the mind, particularly when it comes to building confidence and composure in high-performance environments. So, in the 15 years since his retirement from the kicky business, Paul has built a new career working with leaders and teams from the field of sport, business, healthcare, and the public sector, helping them to challenge the old ego-driven narratives of leadership and perform at their best, even when it's sweaty underpants time. Paul says leadership becomes a problem the moment it turns into something about you. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Hi, Giles. Thanks for that intro. That's the first time I've ever been introduced by like that, which is definitely novel and unique.
Lovely. Good stuff. Right, Paul, seven quick fires. London or Belfast?
Belfast, obviously.
Easy, tap in. Curiosity or confidence?
Curiosity.
Cockerels or canaries?
Oh, that's a great question. Oh, I think they're going to go canaries.
Okay. It's a highbrow Tottenham or Norwich one there. Raise the floor or raise the ceiling?
Raise the floor.
Nice. University of Staffordshire or St. Mary's Christian Brothers Grammar School?
Christian Brother Grammar School.
Right, we've got two more. Who's your favourite lorry, McMenemy or Sanchez?
Considering I retired because of Lorry Sanchez, I'm going to go McMenemy.
That's very fair. Right, and then slightly ridiculously, but not really, when once you've read the book, Aunt Jean or Jürgen Klinsmann?
Aunt Jean, all day long. Best human you'll ever come across. Pretty amazing woman.
Fantastic. Love it. Well, you sailed through those, Paul. Listen, thank you so much for joining us. We make a point when we have our guests, and I believe your guest 170, if you can believe it.
Nice.
Of asking guests to describe the career of you know, how it all started and how they got to where they are. Interestingly, and the original motive for that is to really emphasize how careers are often very wiggly, and that people don't step out of a shiny university straight into a shiny career. Now, mostly, and certainly it's unusual to have someone have an international football career in the middle of where they are now from where they began. But can you share with our listeners how your story began?
Yeah, definitely. The origin is, as you mentioned earlier, when you asked me between Belfast and London, is growing up in Belfast in the 70s, 80s and 90s. Which it was effectively in the middle of a civil war. And so growing up in that environment was pretty unique, pretty interesting for probably people on the outside looking in. But what was looking back for me now was fascinating how it was just so normal that Everything you did those days were typical things a young kid and a young kid around the world would do, which is get up in the morning, go to school, come back, go and get your friends from the street, go out and play, come back in, and you know, if your mom would be standing at the door calling you in to make sure you're in before whatever time you needed to be in for, and then you're going to bed and you have that on repeat pretty much for most of the week, most of the year. And the only difference is that against that backdrop, there were bombs going off pretty much on a daily basis, and we had, instead of having nice cars driving down the street, we would have had tanks or Saracens driving down a street, and instead of people walking to work, which there were obviously lots of people walking to work or getting the bus or in the car, we had British soldiers walking past them in the full regalia with their rifles walking past with just at any stage ready to pounce and get into action. So it's probably very surreal for anyone looking at it. I'm sure when the media would report it in the 80s and 90s, I'm sure people were thinking that is the last place I would ever want to go and visit. It's probably a bit like the way people see maybe like a, you know, a kind of Gaza or something like that now. They just see all this stuff happen and think, my goodness, I could never go there because it wouldn't be safe. And that's effectively what the opinion was of Belfast outside of Belfast in the days I was growing up.
And it must be weird looking back at that, because presumably at the time, given, I suppose, most things are relative, that was the norm because there was no other comparison to suggest it wasn't to you.
Absolutely. And it was only whenever I was 16 and I'd actually signed for Tottenham Hotspur at that stage, and I left home. So left all that, you know, community of family and friends and a very, very stable home life that I had, even with all of the stuff that was going on, and even friends, you know, from my street, from my school, had the opposite side of that, where they were, you know, in the middle of all the stuff that was happening. And so, you know, broken families, losing family members because of what was going on. And, you know, I was the opposite. I was so fortunate that I had a loving family, a family that weren't political. So they were, you know, very much keeping me away from anything that could have led me down a path that wouldn't have been helpful. And then, of course, because I had the football focus, it allowed me to not wanting to do anything to distract away from getting across to play for Tottenham Hotspur, which obviously was not just my dream. All the kids in our street, all the kids in Belfast across Ireland, we all wanted to be professional footballers and all wanted to play in the English Premier League. So coming across to join Spurs in 94 was just such an amazing experience. And, you know, I think about it now, and it was only whenever I think about my mum at the door that day and crying her eyes out as I left the house, and I was wondering why. This is, you know, one of the happiest days of my life. I'm going to pursue my dream of being a professional footballer. But of course, as you know, as I know now as a parent, she knew that I was never coming home. And that was the case of me moving out as a 16-year-old kid.
It's weird when you look back, I guess the benefit of the rearview mirror over, you know, time has passed and you can kind of see it through those different lenses. I mean, listeners to this podcast know I'm a massive Spurs fan, but prior to signing for Spurs at 16, did you have any kind of weekend jobs, paper rounds? Like, what were you doing? And presumably you had a backup plan if the football career didn't materialise. Like, did you have any intentions to go into any other type of career?
Well, you'd think that if you were being very mature about it, but unfortunately, I didn't have those thoughts, but my mum did. So, for instance, she made the decision whenever I passed my 11 plus and as an 11-year-old that instead of going to the school that you didn't need to pass your 11 plus to go and play football, which is the school that I wanted to go to because that was the best school and I was the best school for football in the area. For example, one of my friends played there and then went on to become a Manchester United player in that treble winning squad of 99. His name's Philip Mulryan. So he started in the 99 season at Manchester United with David Beckham and Giggs and Scholes and Keane before he got sold to Norwich City and in the end of 99, early 2000s. And so Phil was at the school that I wanted to go to, but because it wasn't a Christian Brothers school and because it was a better standard of education, my mum sent me to the Irish Christian Brothers school. And of course, because it's a Christian Brothers school, we didn't play anything apart from Irish sports. So we just did Gaelic and hurling, which meant I then chose the path around not playing football. So as much as there was a backup plan from my mum's side, I was always just like, I go to school, I get pretty good grades. I'm not necessarily trying my best to get them, but, you know, 3 A's, 3 B's, 3 C's, and the GCSEs was pretty okay for someone who didn't really try. And all I wanted to do was play football. So out of the days when you're not playing football or training during the week, I was just playing at the weekend. And of course, ended up playing Gaelic football as well. But in terms of a job, it was simply like a, you know, paper round, as you mentioned, and occasionally worked in a bar collecting glasses for a little bit of extra money. But that was about it. There wasn't really anything else apart from the focus of going to school and playing football all the rest of the time.
Yeah, and the other thing which I've spotted, there's very few patterns, as I say, over the 6 years we've been doing this, but those early jobs and early careers that tend to shape people, often they go into people's early 20s, whether it's, you know, working frontline, kind of customer service type gigs before then entering our world or the world that I inhabit of marketing and kind of business. But by the time you were, as you say, 16, 17, 18, all of these years, you were found yourself in a dressing room with the likes of Jürgen Klinsmann. It must have been so intimidating, yet so inspiring.
It's really hard to define and really crystallize what that time in my life, what it did for me, because It's funny, I have a really good friend called Leon Lloyd, who's a former England rugby player and won, you know, 2 Heineken Cups with Adam Hayes and Leicester Tigers team of the early 2000s with Martin Johnson as their captain. And, you know, and he has a great saying, not that it's his, but he uses it a lot, is that, you know, he's a product of his environment. So he always says, but he was never the best player, and yet he scored the winner in the European or Heineken Cup final in the last minute. So, you know, still an amazing player. But he said, I'm just a product of my environment, because if you're around Martin Johnson and you want to do what Martin Johnson does, it's kind of hard not to attain those standards every day. And so what I didn't realize whenever I stepped into this high-performance environment of a Premier League club in 1994, and yet, of course, I'm only a 16-year-old kid on my first day with no idea, no concept of what it will take to become a Premier League footballer or to have a long-term professional career. But I suppose not just professional footballers, whether young or old, you know, kids, babies, new people joining, new starters in a company, new recruits to the military. We all learn by observing behaviors. And when you see what other people are doing, and when I saw how Jurgen Klinsmann trained, you know, our coach, our youth team coach, used to say to us, and I just look at Jurgen when he's training, because he did not walk at any stage. He didn't stop until the whistle went, and then it was like, you go and get a drink while we get sorted again. But the rest of the time, he was constantly on his toes, and that was just something that never happened for the rest of the players. Even someone like Teddy, who was, you know, probably the best player in the team before Jurgen came. But the fact that Jurgen never ever was on just flat-footed, and he was always ready to pounce, always ready to, you know, get an edge on his defender or his opponent. And it's those kind of things where you're just like, all right, I need to do that. And then, of course, you see people like, I just mentioned his name, Teddy Sheringham, you know, the fact that he was out then practicing free kicks, he was practicing his finishing, he was practicing penalties. I remember having a conversation with Teddy on my first year when I'd signed professional forms in early 1996. And of course, he just starred up front this year in Euro 96. And, you know, I just remember sitting in pre-season, we were both sitting on a ball. So I really remember it really graphically, sitting on the ball at the training ground at Chigwell Lodge in Chigwell. And I remember speaking to him, just going, Teddy, how did you hit that penalty in the semi-final of the European Championships against Germany? And because the standard of penalties that was being hit, and of course we know that, you know, Gareth Southgate missed his, but the 10 penalties prior to Gareth Southgate missing his were all top corner. And I was like, how did you do that? Like, just what were you thinking? And he was like, I just knew I was going to score. I was just so confident. And then, of course, he's telling me that after I've watched them for 2 years practicing penalties every day. So there's all of these things that just start to slowly, piece by piece, are building the blocks of what you think it might take to become a professional footballer. And then, of course, while I'm doing the, let's say, the hard yards on the pitch, the running sessions. And I think this is where you probably take away this, I don't even know. It's almost like a gloss, or the, you know, how attractive it might be to be a professional footballer. It's really not. It's absolutely horrendous. It's like, if you want to be pushed to your limits every single day, if you want to be at a point where people are standing on you just to get ahead, it's like, that is horrible, horrendous. It's really not a nice place to be, because everybody's trying to outdo everybody. If you have a massive group of alpha males who are all trying to be the best and all trying to exert their ego on top of everyone else, and you still want to try and compete with that, it's a really, really rough place to do. So there's nothing attractive about it at all. But whenever you see that that's what it takes, and then at the same time, I'm reading books like Tony Robbins' Awaken the Giant Within, and just understanding this personal development angle and aspect that's running alongside my professional football career, of essentially going, well, actually, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. You don't have to do anything that people haven't done before. Just copy what the best are doing. So I was then just trying to map, what's Teddy doing every day? What's Ginola doing every day? What's Darren Anderton doing every day? What's Ian Walker? What's Nick Barnby? What's Jurgen Klinsmann? What's Ozzie Ardiles? What are Jerry Francis, our manager, former England captain? You know, all these guys who are at the very top of their game. It's not rocket science, because it's simple. in terms of what's needed, but it's just not easy.
What you're describing now in terms of the, it feels a little bit dog eat dog in terms of people trying to get ahead of everyone else within this very alpha group.
That's a nice way of saying it.
Yeah. Does the stereotype of what I kind of mentioned in your intro, that maybe dated ego-driven narrative of leadership, did that feel quite rife still? Because for me, is, and I'm saying this maybe through the lens of just a fan, the likes of, I suppose, Arsene Wenger, what he introduced into football, and you can say more recently, you know, Conte and his obsession with marginal gains, it feels more modern to suggest that it isn't such an alpha ego-driven space. Did it at the time feel like that, or did it even then, did you notice these kind of marginal gains?
I would probably say it was less prominent.
Yeah.
People weren't going out to be the best professional that they could be. And probably the opposite, it's that people were trying their best to stay within the herd. So, of course, we're all social creatures. We all need to try and be accepted by the group. And again, it's interesting whenever you hear the likes of Gary Neville and Roy Keane and Scholes, etc., Wayne Rooney, those guys talking about, maybe not Wayne Rooney because it's more a 90s United thing, but it's more how at that time, walking into the Man United dressing room in the 90s, you had to walk in and you had to be like, you'd have to stand up and be counted. You couldn't go in and be like, oh, I'm not going to do this, because you'd have Roy Keane or you'd have Peter Schmeichel or Steve Bruce or Eric Cantona. Brian Robson, these guys literally standing over you, forcing you. And if you didn't do it, you'd be literally kicked out. So that was the herd mentality, is you want to be accepted by the group, but the group standards are here, which kind of leads me back to where what I mentioned around Leon and Martin Johnson. The reason why Martin Johnson was the captain of that England World Cup winning team is because his standards were so exceptional that wherever he went, people raised their standards to his level and hopefully, you know, bettered them. But of course, that was the minimum requirement. So all the things we're doing in the kind of the early days of my career, the 90s, early 2000s, people were, yes, the standards are there. But once you get to that standard, there weren't too many. Possibly you might put an Eric Cantona, maybe a Zola, people like that, into the category of going, yeah, but I'm going to do it differently. I'm going to do it the way I want to do it and go above and beyond. And then, of course, you start seeing examples like, you know, Johnny Wilkinson, who just go out and obsessively try and kick, you know, 1,000 balls over the bar or whatever. But then it became, oh, actually, it's not just a Dave Brailsford thing. It's not just the Team Sky or Team GB cycling. It's like people across all sports, across all countries, whether it's the American sports and the NFL, NBA, etc., they're all trying to get better. Oh, how do you do that? Oh, actually, there's just a relentless pursuit of excellence, of how do we keep improving? And of course, as the professionalism and the standards and the stats started creeping in more and more and more, actually you could then compare yourself not just as a team, but just as individuals of how good you were and what level you were operating at. Time, weather, and...
We interrupt this podcast to announce that we will never interrupt this podcast with ads. Ads that awkwardly nudge you to contact the pod's host, Giles Edwards. Only last week, some pod listening companies did just that, calling for guidance on proper marketing. But we're not asking you to do that. Nope. Anyway, back to the show.
Marketing is incredibly confused with sales.
I think you're the one who's more confused, Gary V, Sunshine. Here we go.
We're here in part to plug your latest book, It's Not About You, The Psychology of Leadership. I should also mention that after writing your first book, The Stupid Footballer Is Dead, you almost, I think, vowed that you would never write another book again. So I'm going to ask you how that came about soon. But the pressure you're describing now and that kind of intense environment that you're expected to kind of thrive, I suppose, or I suppose not cope, pressure is often talked about as something that people just have to, I guess, handle or push through. Were these kind of patterns of behavior, were these things that you realized at the time, or is it looking back now, you kind of notice these patterns and how, you know, what leadership really looks like?
What do you mean by patterns?
Patterns you talk about in the psychology of leadership. So in your book, there's so many stories about, you know, I guess the parallels between the dressing room and, say, the boardroom. the thing that stood out for me, and I, you know, it's not, it comes across obviously in the title of the book, is that there isn't this kind of set way to lead. So during your career, and it'd be wrong for me not to mention your, you know, close to 300 professional appearances, 20 odd caps for Northern Ireland. Did you realize at the time that there were these different types of leaderships? Is that something that you kind of observed and this is almost looking back? Or was it not till post retiring and then you kind of looked back and realized these different forms of leadership?
Yeah, I think the leadership is definitely different probably to what we've just talked about in the first 20 minutes of this, because I think what it's interesting, the reason why I probably thought about not writing the book is because it took so much effort to write the first one in 2011. But then, of course, that was less than a year after I'd stopped playing. And because it had nearly 20 years in football, it seemed like an ideal topic to talk about. But now I've gone into the 32nd year of my career and having 16 years away from professional football now, it was actually, I've just worked in, you know, leadership and performance and teamwork for those, you know, 1.5 decades since. So it seemed like an ideal topic to talk around with the leadership. And actually it was the leadership styles that I, again, back to what I mentioned earlier, I observed through the years. So my first manager, you talked about Laurie McMenemy, was my first Northern Ireland manager. You know, just very, very traditional, didn't really get involved in much coaching or training, just, you know, was more of a figurehead, very much managing egos was the way you do it. Although ironically, at the very end of my career, my last manager was Paul Lambert, who had the exact same approach in that he never took a training session, he didn't get involved in anything, pretty much stood there mostly silent for 80 to 90% of the training session, you know, 1.5, 2.5 hour session, and wouldn't say pretty much anything. But when he did say something, when he spoke, his words had so much impact and carried so much weight because of his credibility as a player and what he understood of the game. So the leadership styles, of course, you know, varied all the way through to, you know, the leaders who tried to be your friend, but then probably fell flat in their face because then became quite two-faced whilst they're trying to be your friend, but then also knew they couldn't be. All the way through to understanding how leaders operate in the business world and the way they do things now. And I think that the reason why I wrote the book now, and actually the first title was The Psychology of Leadership, because that's one of the titles of my keynotes that I deliver. But it's also, I felt for a book, it was quite dry. I thought, well, you know, The Psychology of Leadership, who's going to want to pick that up? You know, unless you're really, really into leadership and sort of corporate level function, and then maybe that's not the best title. But I was having it out of the interviews we did for it. We interviewed a lady called Emily Janssen, who's from America, and she was the first female GM of an MLB team. And I was like, Emily, so tell me, you know, what's leadership to you? And the first line she said was, well, Paul, it's not about you, is it? I was like, and it almost had just encapsulated the 15 other interviews that we'd done and that we'd recorded. And all of them pretty much had the theme of, it's not about the person. It's not about the person in charge. It's not the person leading. And when she said that, I was like, actually, that's really true. So that the book that I've done now is, it's not about you, The Psychology of Leadership. But actually what we've talked about at the start here, Giles, is my next book, which coming out at the end of this year, which is the second in the series of three, which is, it's all about you, The Psychology of Performance.
Okay. So,
interestingly, I was less worried about leadership when I was playing, because I just needed to do my own job and I needed to concentrate on just what I could deliver. Because of course, if I'm not delivering, if I'm not performing, I'm not leading anyone on the sidelines.
And presumably during your career, there were different types of leaders. They weren't all necessarily managers and coaches. There were players, you know, captains, and also players who weren't captains. I guess from the title of your book, that suggests that leaders, you know, come in all shapes and sizes, right?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I think there's so many ways that you can take leadership examples. And I think that's why, you know, I try to cover it from everything from, you know, prime ministers to business leaders to, you know, engineers and everything in between, because there's just so many ways to lead either yourself, a group of people, you know, a country, almost like you can be a thought leader, So the lots of these, you know, depending on the angle you're taking and what you're discussing, it definitely has so many permutations of what leadership is, and obviously trying to define it, you know, showcase of how it can be used, but also more importantly, how it applies to your life. And I think that's one of the things that I probably learned the best, that especially going back to the early days at Tottenham Hotspur, like these guys really were the kind of the best in the world. They were the highest profile players, whether it was in England or around the world. And, you know, just go back to the two people I've mentioned, whether it's Teddy Sheringham, who I think the year I joined had just won the Golden Boot in the Premier League. Just mentioned about him being, you know, Alan Shearer's partner up front with the two of those guys. Then, of course, Teddy then went and won the treble at Man United. So, you know, just such an incredible career. And of course, Jurgen Klinsmann, who when he signed in my first day and his first day on 1st of July 1994, and he'd already won a World Cup with West Germany in 1990. So being around these people and seeing how they operate was such a privilege, but also the way that they led themselves with such humility. I just couldn't get over that, because I probably must have had the preconception that, you know, they're probably going to be a bit arrogant, probably like, don't talk to me. You know, you go and sit over there with the kids. Whereas the best example I can give you is not Teddy or Jurgen, but actually when David Ginola signed, and he would come in to the Spurs Lodge canteen every morning, and he would walk around from, and it didn't matter who he came into contact with first, he'd just shake the closest person's hand, but he would shake everybody's hand in the entire canteen who was in there. Sometimes there'd be five people, sometimes there'd be 40 people, and he'd shake everybody's hand and go and say hello to them, look them in the eye, good morning. Good morning. Now, it took a lot of time, but that's not the point. The point is that he actually took the time, whether it was a first team player, a reserve team player, a youth team player, the kit man, the security guard, the chef, whoever, everybody. And I was just like, this guy's like as high on a pedestal you can possibly get. His first year at Spurs, he won the double player of the year, or the players player and the football incredible writers. You know, he was doing TV ads. He looked like a movie star. He's French, 6'2", you know, just everything about him was just magnificent. He was just such an amazing guy and incredibly humble. And I was like, wow, there's nothing this guy can't do. So, you know, all of these things just give you a really, really good impression of how to try and get to that pinnacle of what, you know, millions and billions of kids all like me growing up in Belfast wanted to do. And then, of course, giving you the example of what happens when you get there. This is how you behave.
Yeah, that's incredible. The picture I was just painting of Ginola walking around shaking hands had a cigarette in the other hand as well, incidentally.
No, that was on a slide 8.
What a legend. I was going to ask you, what are the key maybe misconceptions we have about leadership? Like, what's the one ingredient that does seem to always appear? But you just mentioned humility. Is it as simple as that? There must be others.
I wouldn't say no. Definitely not all leaders. I wouldn't say all leaders are humble. In fact, probably I'd say the minority are. I'd say most that I've come across are the opposite. It's like they know the position they're in. They know the power and influence they have. They probably like exerting it. Whether that's just the way it had always been, and it's obviously changing now, and, you know, and more people are having a voice, and, you know, it's less hierarchical, especially in the corporate world, you know, where you used to have a kind of leader, the boss, in that kind of corner office and, you know, closed door, no one was having access to them. And of course, very, very different now. You know, it's most of the leaders that I know in the corporate world across the world are all trying to be as accessible as possible to their teams. If they can, of course, they've had huge demands on them, and they're constantly being pulled all over the place. But it's the fact that when they can do that, when they can get in and have a conversation and get to meet different people in different offices, because they need to understand what their people are going through, what's their challenges, what are they thinking about, and how they can ultimately empower them to be at their best.
I don't mind being the scapegoat of this example, but I did a leadership course about 15 years ago. And it may well have been hugely flawed, but one of the few things I do remember coming out of it with was the idea that there isn't a right way to lead, or the right shape of a leader, or, you know, there isn't that sort of consistency where I have to just behave like someone different. I think the way it was articulated was, anyone can be a leader, and you almost have to become an exaggerated version of yourself. How does that fit with your experience? Because, I mean, that in itself sounds a bit simple. I think it was a case of identifying and dialing up where appropriate to the individual was maybe the key lesson there.
Yeah, no, and I think, and listen, I was going to be a little bit critical. It sounds a little bit contrite the way you were talking there, but
it does, Paul. And to be honest, it's also worth adding that I'm a terrible leader, and I fully recognise that. So I'm obviously an agency. I have, you know, we have teams of people and staff, and you know, colleagues that I work with. And I know, you know, I don't mind admitting, I think I'm very good at what I do. I'm just really not very good at leading. So it didn't help me in the slightest, that advice.
Well, what I was going to say was it's also just a sign of the times, which is maybe just back to some of the examples that I'm given. It is just a sign of the time. So, you know, probably one of the other things that probably just to give us some context of anyone who might not be aware that, you know, I'm saying being a professional footballer, whether as a, you know, 16-year-old kid competing against other 16-year-old kids in the team. But of course, you're bringing together the best players in the country to get into that youth team at Spurs. And like we got into the playoff, we get into the FA Youth Cup final, gives you an idea of just how kind of good we were as a team, because we played against Manchester United and Phil Neville and all those guys in that year and lost. So the players you're competing at whatever level, it is so hard because everybody's pushing, everybody's trying to get to that point. And of course, as you go higher, professional, playing against the pros, then you're playing against first team players, playing against Premier League players, etc. Unbelievably difficult. But at the same time, we were going out drinking, you know, 2 or 3 times a week. So we clearly weren't being the best versions of a professional footballer, but because lots of people were doing that, that was probably quite acceptable. And it wasn't only until the kind of the probably mid-90s when the European players started to come in, like kind of the Ruud Gullits, the Vialis, the Zolas, the Ginolas, the Klinsmans, who were coming in and didn't have that mentality of I go train, work really hard, and then I go to the pub, because that's what people did before. And of course, it was a big reputation at Arsenal doing it as well. Man United had the same kind of behaviours in the 90s as well in their dressing room, like the Roy Keane, so openly admits of what they would do after training. But then it changed, and then it started becoming really, really professional. People going, actually, it's not about my social life, it's about how can I maximise my professional career, because it's very short. And of course, then the money just started becoming, you know, astronomical, and people could realize, like me, you could have a career where you live comfortably for nearly 20 years and then you come out of professional football and then you work afterwards and do whatever you want to do. Or you can go in and within a couple of years, you can set yourself up and your family for the next 5 generations for life, because there's so much reward there. So it's really interesting how the kind of that shift in professionalism has happened over my career. And of course, 15 years later,
I think it's also, we should recognise, Paul, that you were well ahead of the curve, right? I mean, I've heard you talk about the reaction to when you turned up with your yoga mat at Norwich. Whereas now, you probably can't move for yoga mats in training grounds, right? I would have thought.
I definitely didn't see myself as that leader, as someone trying to, you know, outsmart the opposition. I was just, based on the fact that I read this Tony Robbins book when I was 17, of, you know, just trying to design my life as opposed to just let life happen to me. And of course, one of the goals I set myself whenever I was a 17-year-old kid, when I first read it, 1995, was I would love to retire, or I would love to choose to stop playing, actually was the way I phrased it, when I finish professional football at 35, injury free. So if that's my goal as a young kid, I went, okay, that's jump straight to the end. That's my goal. And the reason, of course, why I would set a goal like that is because I used to walk into the Spurs physio room every single day before training, and I'd see our skipper, you know, our kind of talisman, a guy who played 600-700 games for Spurs, Gary Mabbott, on the physio table getting strapped up for probably 30 minutes every day just to go out train. And he was only in his mid-30s. Like when he stopped playing, he was probably 35, 36 when he left Spurs. And I'm going, this guy is a physical wreck. Like, don't get me wrong, the loveliest guy in the world. He helped me so much. He's amazing. Still now, good friend now. But his body was a mess, an absolute wreck. And I was like, that's the last thing I want. Complete last thing I want. So talking about the yoga mats, I was going, well, how do I become injury free when I stop playing? Mum suggested I try yoga. Why don't I try it? it started working. I saw my flexibility increase. And then over the 20 years of playing professional football, I was very, very fortunate that I literally had one muscle injury. And that was because we were doing a shooting session in pre-season that we probably shouldn't have been doing, and I pulled a thigh muscle. But apart from that, never had a muscle injury. And again, you can say Amazing. That's really lucky, a coincidence, or is it down to the fact that I was doing yoga every day? Who knows?
Yeah, well, exactly. All you can do is be kind of, I suppose, intentional about how you're behaving and how you're shaping that career, rather than just let it happen, is to steal your own words. I'm mindful of time, Paul, so I think I'm going to go to our listener questions. So as I said, we've had quite a few in. So asking the general public for their opinion, be it on Brexit or boat names, is notoriously fraught with danger. So I'm going to select the first one you don't have to answer. It's just, I work with a guy called Elliot, who's a Man United fan, and he's said, did you watch the game on Saturday? So Elliot can fuck right off. And I'll remind him that Spurs beat Man United 4 times last season.
And that I scored against Man United as well. So you can have that.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so there, Elliot. All right, Amy says, what's one habit you've picked up that's actually made a difference over time?
That's a great question. What's one habit I've picked up that actually makes a difference over time?
Is there anything your routine or anything that you think, you know, people maybe don't do that should? I mean, yoga is probably not a bad one.
Right. You know what? I'll probably give you a longer winded answer to that, but only because I feel like it's quite challenging, you know, as in it'll probably challenge you, it'll probably challenge Amy, it could challenge, you know, quite a few people who might hear this. So mentioned that the first book I did in 2011, book came out last year, is one of three. So this year it's going to be It's All About You, The Psychology of Performance. And then next year is the third in that series called It's All About Us, The Psychology of Teamwork. So then in 2028, I'm going to release my fifth book, which is called 4-0 to Hero. So that from zero to hero, it's going to be 4-0 to Hero. And the reason why is because I feel like I have personally transformed my life in the last 2 years. So hear me out. Since probably June 2024, what I have done is, for me, transformational. So first of all, I stopped alcohol. So that's a pretty big thing when you're an Irish guy and he's been drinking for 30 years. So I stopped drinking alcohol. So straight away, stopped drinking, no alcohol calories coming into my body. I then have been running, and obviously that doesn't cost anything. I had started fasting in the last 2 years. So I do a weekly 36-hour fast, which obviously is challenging for some people when you start it, but to not eat for 36 hours, basically from the end of Sunday's dinner over to Tuesday morning, I don't eat. I also do cold baths, which is, by now, once you've done them for a long time, it doesn't really make any difference, but starting them can be really, really challenging. So all of these things all put together have actually cost me, and the last thing I should have just said was, and in the last 6 months, I've just stopped eating sugar or like kind of processed refined sugar, like so with biscuits, sweets, crisps, all those kind of things, desserts, cakes. So all of those things combined, going back to Amy's question, has transformed my life in that I'm probably fitter, healthier, in better shape now than I've been, definitely since my football days, but nearly better than my football days, because I had a lot of rubbish but trained a lot, so was in really good shape. And it has cost me a combined total of £0.
Amazing.
So when I tell people about how all of these things that I'm doing, and I don't tell them when people ask me about them, I'm trying to tell them that actually, not only do I not do more, so I don't go to the gym, I don't pay for extra things, I don't pay for classes, I don't pay, there's nothing that I've paid for. I actually have stopped all these things, and those five things all together have completely transformed my life, which is why the book, I feel, could be very beneficial for people. Because when most people go, I can't lose weight because I can't get to the gym because I can't afford it or don't have the time, I'm like, do this, doesn't cost you any money. I can't do this, okay, well, stop doing this. You're actually reducing things as opposed to doing more things. So all of these things combined feels like there is a huge transformation that has happened in my life purely because I've stopped things.
That's a great answer. You were talking about being accessible earlier. I love this because, as you say, it is so accessible. You can't use can't use lack of money for a gym membership as an excuse. So yeah, there's no excuses on this one.
Or a cold bath. You don't even have to pay for warm water. Yeah. Just literally turn the tap on. You don't have to turn your heating on.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's the most economical tip you could ever have given. That's wonderful. I love it. I do love it. I'm going to get another one in quickly. So Alex asks, what's the one thing people romanticize about football that isn't true?
I think I just told you earlier about how the shiny, oh, this amazing professional football, Sky Sports, TNT, Premier League, Champions League, World Cup. And you know, if people are just like, oh, this is, I'd love to do that. And you're like, I'm like, no, you wouldn't. No, I'd love to be a no, you really wouldn't want to do it. I wouldn't give you 5 minutes. I'll give you 3 minutes on a pitch with a professional football team and you will beg me to come off, because not only will you be exhausted, you'll be embarrassed, you'll be out of your depth, people will be shouting and screaming in your face, and then if they're not doing it, the 50,000 people watching you will be embarrassed.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
there's
yeah.
so much dog's abuse, not just you and your family, and it's like, you really don't want to do it. So that is probably the best way to put it. But also, when the analogy I give whenever, you know, I say about I chose to stop football whenever I was 32, I was, you know, decided I'd done what I needed to do. I'd won a couple of titles, you know, played from a country, won a trophy at Wembley, got promoted, got relegated, all these stuff, everything you can do, I'm happy to step away. And then they're like, oh, do you miss it? And I'm like, absolutely not. It's like you run a marathon every day for 20 years. And then after 20 years, someone goes, don't have to run a marathon today. And you're like, no, no.
Fantastic. Again, awesome answer. So, Paul, the final part of the interview is our four pertinent poses that we put to all of our guests. So number one, what advice would you give to your younger self?
Just keep going.
Yeah, nice.
If you want me to elaborate, I can do, but it's just that's the fact that people just struggle. Actually currently going through it, building this technology platform that we are at the minute. You know, we're pretty much building the first, almost like the Airbnb of booking professional speakers around the world. And it's just challenging because you're constantly coming up with, you know, issues that you've never seen before. You're trying to be asked to have a skill set that you don't have. And that constantly, how do you keep getting over these hurdles and obstacles? But like the answer to your question you just asked was just keep going.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, no, that's great advice. If you could banish one thing from your industry, what would it be and why?
I just want players to act like they're tough.
Okay.
Because the opposite's happening now. So I didn't, in Gaelic football, I went home to Belfast a couple of years ago and I trained with my old team, and just the level of toughness, like they're just, it's a bit like what I perceive rugby players to be. You know, rugby players on a pitch, no one is trying to give the impression that they're hurt or that they're sore or they need to fall over. It's like the opposite. It's like, you can stand on my hand, I'm like getting up like, you know, you haven't hurt me, that's okay. I don't want to give anybody a mental edge. Whereas in football, it's the opposite. It's like, I just feel like there's just so much, so embarrassing when you see players going down with this feigning an injury and being hurt. And I'm like,
shout out to Ollie Mines. So Ollie is a creative copywriter that used to work here at Gasp. I think it was England under 19s he represented in rugby, and he played for Esher, which isn't too far away. So we used to go and watch him play sometimes. I remember going to a couple of games, and he was playing a Geordie team, definitely a team from Newcastle. Anyway, honestly, it was like something from Game of Thrones battlefield. It was intense. It was so violent, like not just eye gouging. We're talking like proper, you know, I'm sure someone lost a leg at some point. But yeah, you're absolutely right. And in my mind, Gaelic football is like that. But then added up another notch. So
yeah.
Love it. Are there any books that you can recommend to our listeners? I mean, you've named one already, which hasn't actually ever come up before, so that might be worth a
which
plug.
Which one did it name?
Not others. Tony's book.
Tony Robbins. Yeah, Awaken the Talent Within. Well, it was so seminal for me that, you know, it really changed the course of my life. And actually, interestingly, I just met a friend. I was having a coffee with a friend who I didn't realize has sold his business for over 300 million. And we were chatting about investment in the business. And when I told him, and he was kind of didn't realize that I'd read that book in 1995 as a 17-year-old and changed my life. And he literally put up off the seat and come over and high five. And he goes, I read the same book and it had the same impact on me whereas like I thought I could do anything. And of course he went on and sold his business for 300 million. So it is just, it's been so powerful, and not just the Tony Robbins book. It's like, it's everything he does about that guy just seems to change people's life. In terms of another book, it actually probably should get shares in his marketing department or something, but I read a book that Tony Robbins wrote on money, and that really transformed my life, because obviously having been a young player, and you know, I got my first six-figure contract from Tottenham Hotspur when I was 19, and you know, you suddenly had been around money and financial investments and pensions and all these SIPs and everything from very early on, but I'd always given it into the hands of someone else, whether it's a financial advisor or another company. And actually after reading this book Money, it completely transformed my opinion of what I should do with my own finances. So I took 100% control back of everything that I had to be able to go, okay, it's my responsibility. I'm going to decide where it goes. I'm going to invest it, all based off Tony Robbins' book. And it's actually since I've had my responsibility of my own finances, my pension has increased 100% because of the choices that I've made off the back of that book. So it's really, really incredible. And it's not like, it's not rocket science. It's just like, you know, buy the FTSE 100, buy the S&P, buy the NASDAQ, because essentially over the 250 odd years of statistics, it has grown 8% every year, no matter you take into account for world wars and famines and all these other things, but essentially an 8% on average increase. So he says, you just have to get in and just hold it and let it just grow and grow, because ultimately every 7 years, there's going to be a stock market crash. And that's only a stock market crash, is only a 20% adjustment in the market. And within 12 months of that stock market crash, there's always a new all-time high. So obviously anybody who wants to fact check can go and have a look. But essentially that's what Tony Robbins said in the book. And I was like, all right, that sounds pretty simple. And I've done it, and it's amazing, the returns.
Nice. Smart. Okay, well, we'll link to both of those in this episode's listing. And then the last one, Paul, is we always dedicate every episode to someone, and we bestow or hospital pass that honour, depending on your view, to our guest, who has to give their reason why. So would you dedicate this episode?
I think you mentioned her right at the start, and I think she's a great person to dedicate it to, is my Aunt Jean. Because when you probably ask the question, most people would be like, Aunt Jean, Jürgen Klinsmann, what's the connection and who is she? Well, amazing, amazing woman. Very, very high level overview of her life is, grew up in Belfast, entered an X Factor style competition in the 60s as a 19-year-old woman. The winner of that competition was getting a one-year recording contract with Decca Records. She won the competition, turned down the prize because it didn't come with a pension, and she was a civil servant in Belfast at the time. The second place in that competition was a lady called Dana, who went on to win the Eurovision Song Contest for Ireland and had an amazing music career. But my Aunt Jean ended up emigrating to America, eventually worked at Harvard for 30 years and just had the most incredible experience with, you know, she used to do dinners for like world leaders like Desmond Tutu, Nelson Mandela, Gorbachev, all these people came across over the 30 years she was organizing dinners for. In the 90s, she sang at JFK's mom's funeral in Boston, eventually decided to, in her late 50s, decided just as she was finishing her career at Harvard to start her own degree at Harvard. And in the last couple of years, she just graduated from Harvard University. And I just did my TED talk on her in 2025, because I'm like, do you know what? If that doesn't believe, that doesn't make you believe that anything is possible, I don't know what will.
Yeah. Amazing. What a wonderful woman. Well, she told you to shoot for the stars, and you talk about her in the book, and I'll link to the TED talk as well. So yeah, what an appropriate and what an absolutely brilliant dedication. This episode is very proudly dedicated to Aunt Jean.
Legend.
What a legend she is. As a final call to action then, everyone listening, if you head over to the listing, wherever you listened to your podcast, there'll be links to everything we've discussed. Both of Paul's books, but stay tuned for others. His TED talk, which he very briefly had a chance to mention, but we didn't go into much depth. How else can our listeners get more Paul McVeigh?
The best way is just to go onto our website for what we do in terms of working with clients across the world. It's called theleadershipclub.co.uk. And once you go on the Leadership Club, you can see, you know, the range of offerings we have, from whether it's keynotes with myself or our managing director, Adam Davies, who used to be head of performance at Gymshark, who's now running our programs, whether it's all our roster of world-class performers, whether we do dinners for clients, we're offering, you know, offsites, long-term leadership development. So we're very, very fortunate. And I think this has been the biggest pivot in my career in the last 15 years, Giles, is when I realized it's not about me. So it was, I wrote a book on it, and so decided to bring this world-class roster of all these people that I was connected with across the last 15, 30 years, and decided to bring them into our leadership club roster. So whenever we deliver our programs, unlike the competitors we have in this space of, you know, large consultancies that I'm sure you've come across over the years, we get consultants to go in and deliver, and, you know, these consultants, not the new slide on them because they're generally very bright people, very smart, you know, going and delivering this against a backdrop of whatever the framework is their company wants to deliver. But it's not like they've built the multi-million pound company, or they've never played at the highest level in elite sport, or they've never climbed Everest, or they've never done X, Y, and Z, but they know the theory about it. Whereas we're actually getting people who have been at the highest level, climbed Everest, won World Cups, run multi-billion dollar companies, fighter jet pilots, et cetera, et cetera. So that is our USP for whenever we go into work with companies around the world.
Yeah, quite the team you're building. Well, the Leadership Club will also be linked, so if you can look there right now if you're listening and find it. Paul, listen, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a privilege, and it's been a huge pleasure. Thank you very much.
No, thanks for having me, Giles. Good luck with everything.
And finally, thank you to everybody listening. If you've enjoyed the episode, please do share and review the pod. Keep your questions and guest requests coming in. To get in touch, it's easy to find Gasp online or email the mouthful that is calltoaction@gasp.agency.
I can't get no call to action. I can't get no call to action. But I try, and I try, and I try, and I try.